Authors' representatives, otherwise known as literary agents, have done some writing of their own this week. In a missive to the U.S. Department of Justice, the board of the Association of Authors' Representatives has conveyed, quote, in the strongest terms possible, its opposition to a proposed settlement with three publishers over alleged ebook price fixing. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news the publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. And joining me, as always, from his office in New York City is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
We begin our program today on a sad note.
Yes, that's right. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't lead this week without acknowledging the loss of legendary author and illustrator Maurice Sendak, who died on May 8th following a stroke at the age of 83. What an incredible career. Who among us doesn't remember loving Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, among his other works? He won the Caldecott Award in 1964 for Where the Wild Things Are, almost 50 years ago, if my math doesn't escape me. Among his other honors, Sendak became the first and only, and to date, only American to ever win the Hans Christian Andersen Medal for Illustration, which he won in 1970. In 1982, he won a National Book Award in the Picture Book category for Outside Over There. And in 1983, he won the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, given by the American Library Association for an entire body of work. He also won the National Medal of the Arts in 1996. His most recent book was published in September 2011, Bumbleardi. It was the first work in 30 years for which Sendak had produced both text and pictures. And his last book is scheduled to be published in February of 2013. We'll miss Maurice Sendak. So some sad news to start the week.
Indeed, but some good news on somebody you know well.
Yeah, there was some good news on another front. This week we learned that Sarah Nelson, a former editor-in-chief here at Publishers Weekly, and most recently the books editor for O, the Oprah magazine, is moving over to Amazon.com, where she is going to be editorial director, Amazon.com Books. A spokesman for Amazon said that Nelson's going to be leading the company's editorial vision for books in the print and Kindle bookstores on Amazon.com. So in her new role, Sarah Nelson is expected to give a fresh look and voice to Amazon's books homepage. That means possibly writing a column, and she'll be talking up books both on the site and to public events. And I know that she's excited to begin her new job, which starts in June. And we at PW know she's going to do great stuff over there. Now, of course, with all things Amazon, because they are Amazon, you're inevitably going to hear some people raise some questions, and there's some raised eyebrows about somebody of Sarah's stature going to, you know, Amazon. But clearly this is great news. You know, Amazon has just added someone who really knows books and publishing, who loves books and publishing, and is certainly going to work to sell more books and certainly going to work to benefit publishing. Sarah's a great ambassador for reading and a great advocate for books. So congratulations to her and best of luck. We look forward to seeing the great things she's going to be doing there.
Well, we wish her well as well. She's been on Beyond the Book a couple of times, and I think not only is she a great ambassador for reading, as you put it, but she's been a real evangelist for the digital revolution in publishing, too.
Absolutely.
Now, all the news, unfortunately, isn't good in the PW extended family.
No, that's once again another sad note this week. We're sad to report that Madeline Reuter, who's the former longtime news editor of Publishers Weekly, passed away on May 3rd. Calvin Reed has a wonderful remembrance of Reuter on the Publishers Weekly site. Reuter was the news editor here for 16 years. She retired in 1992. And it's amazing to think that her career in publishing spanned everything from the clubby New York publishing world of the 50s to the rise of national bookstore chains and superstores in the 80s, as Calvin eloquently wrote in his piece. One of Madeline's lasting legacies for us, of course, is that she hired Calvin Reed back in 1986 as her assistant. So, you know, from the PW family, our condolences to the family of Madeline Reuter. She was 90 years old, I believe.
Yeah, well, now let's get to the item I mentioned right at the top there. So the literary agents have been doing some writing of their own. The AAR, the Association of Authors' Representatives, has written a letter to the Department of Justice.
Yeah, fun stuff. Back to the Department of Justice. As you may recall, before the settlements with three of the publishers can actually take effect, they have to be approved by a court, and that comes after a 60-day comment period. And those comments are already getting to be pretty interesting. And one of the best takedowns of the DOJ action actually came from an agent, Simon Lipscar. And now this week, the Association of Authors Representatives has a similar takedown. They have a letter to the DOJ circulating. I would really urge readers to go to the PW site and look at Lipscar's nicely written attack on the DOJ action, and take a look at the AAR letter as well, because I do believe they lay out some excellent points as to why the DOJ action will probably not foster competition in the literary marketplace, and in fact, as the AAR suggests, may do the opposite. But a couple of things here I'd like to acknowledge. First, the AAR letter acknowledges that they really have no idea whether the publishers that settled anyway colluded or not. And, you know, all good points that they make aside, that's kind of a key issue here. You know, if these publishing CEOs did indeed get together to discuss a price-based response to Amazon, you know, legal experts pretty much agree, you know, they're kind of sunk. Now, two publishers, Penguin and Macmillan, are, of course, fighting the DOJ charges. So perhaps we'll learn a little bit more about what really went on in the coming months. And the other thing is that while publishers, you know, are really kind of taking the fall, some experts are starting to come out and say that it looks like Apple might actually skate on all of this, which I think would be kind of ironic for, you know, publishers to take such a hard fall here and for Apple to get away with nothing. So in the coming weeks, we're going to be looking more and more at, you know, both the comments that are rolling in on the settlement with the Department of Justice, and also taking a deeper dive into what lies ahead. But I'm pretty confident in saying this right now, that even before this comments period and the fight really starts to get heavy, that, you know, the ebook business and the book business overall is really evolving quite rapidly. And in many ways, if there's more competition and more innovation happening over the next 2 years, I still think it's going to be very, very hard to say any of this was because of the DOJ action, because most of that innovation, frankly, is going on within independents and upstarts who really are not part of that action.
Well, you know, in fact, in the AAR letter, Andrew, Gail Hockman, the president on behalf of the board there, makes a point about innovation. She says, "We do not want to return to an environment in which our clients' intellectual property is irrationally priced in order to stifle innovation." But as you point out, a lot of innovation is going on even as we speak, and there are a couple examples in the upcoming issue.
Yeah, there's two really great examples in the upcoming issue of the kinds of innovation we're seeing, and not always, you know, easy innovation either. In Monday's issue, we have a back page soapbox editorial by Renee Rocco, who's an author who launched the Lyrical Press with her husband, I think back in 2006. And since its launch, not so many years ago, they've ceased putting out print books. They've gone digital only, and they're posting some pretty strong growth. But what I found really interesting is that Lyrical is also what she called a virtual workplace. And they pay editors a royalty percentage of sales from books they've edited rather than a flat rate salary, which sort of gives everyone a financial stake in the book's success. So Lyrical Story is a great example of how the industry is starting to change, how these upstarts particularly are starting to change the industry. And it's certainly worth checking out. Now, also on Monday's issue, Rachel Deal has a look at the latest incarnation of Harvey and Bob Weinstein's new unit. Now, you remember in 2001, the film moguls Bob and Harvey Weinstein launched Miramax Books. Well, they've been through quite a few incarnations since then, and now they're back up and at 'em with a full-time staff of two. Georgina Levitt as the publishing director and Amanda Murray as its editorial director. They're about to release their first spate of titles in some time. And, you know, Rachel Deal's written a great piece with lots of detail, and not the least of which is that the new effort is a largely outsourced company. You know, Perseus is handling all its printing and distribution and selling their rights. And Marie and Levitt are focused on assembling, you know, a lot of largely freelance teams for the 10 or so titles a season they plan to do. I think both these efforts underscore a trend that's both a little exciting and a little frightening at the same time. Clearly, there's a lot of work available for those with publishing skills, from, you know, editorial to publicity to design, but perhaps fewer full-time jobs. But at the same time, we're also seeing a lot of brand new jobs in publishing, especially in the digital realm. So very interesting stuff indeed, and things that we will look forward to exploring a lot more in future issues of Publishers Weekly.
And we look forward to exploring them with you on our Beyond the Book series. Andrew Albanese, features editor for PW. Thanks for joining us today from the newsroom there in New York City.
My pleasure, Chris.
Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, we enjoy having you join us because every week you give us a preview of the reviews, and we'll start out with what's coming up in fiction.
In fiction, Russell Potter's Pig, that's P-Y-G, subtitled The Memoirs of Toby the Learned Pig, is a charming debut novel. Potter movingly imagines the story of a learned pig based on an actual novelty act that toured 18th century England. The real-life pig was simply trained to respond to his master's commands, but Potter's Toby learns how to read, think, and purportedly to write, as this book is his memoir. Toby's earnest quest to be more than a source of amusement animates this fable about enslavement, liberal education, and perhaps animal rights. While Toby was coming of age in England, over in Stockholm, King Gustav III, his brother and a society doyen known as the Uzan schemed to return control of Sweden to the nobility in The Stockholm Octavo by Karen Engelman. They're secretly opposed by a mysterious gambling club owner, also involved as a beautiful apothecary, a master calligrapher, and an obsessive fan maker. And our reviewer says Engelman neatly mixes revolutionary politics with erotic tension and cutthroat rivalry. Elsewhere in the fiction reviews, we have Where'd You Go, Bernadette, Maria Semple's modern-day comic caper about Bee, the eighth-grade daughter of a Microsoft genius and a once-famous architect, who wants to go on a family cruise to Antarctica as a reward for good grades. But her mother goes missing, leading Bee to begin accumulating her mother's invoices, emails, and bills in the hope of finding her. We have a fiction Q&A with Rachel Joyce about her debut novel, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. And prior to writing this book, Joyce acted for 20 years with the Royal Shakespeare Company in England and wrote numerous plays for BBC Radio. So she talks with us about the tradition of literary pilgrimage, having to earn a secret, and how her previous careers prepared her for writing this novel.
In mystery and thrillers, we've got a pair of books that make their points about political issues with horror.
Yeah, we have Rivas Z. Wortham's Burroughs. This is set in 1964 East Texas, in which the discovery of a headless corpse in the Red River and a butchered farm family nearby signals that an escaped lunatic has returned home. And Wortham combines the gonzo sensibility of Joe R. Lansdale and the elegiac mood of To Kill a Mockingbird to strike the right balance between childhood innocence and adult horror. And that political title is Timothy Hallinan's The Fear Artist, in which travel writer Poke Rafferty discovers that the Phoenix Project, with the U.S. employed during the Vietnam War against the communists, has been resurrected for use against terrorists in southern Thailand. And Hallinan gives readers no chance to escape from his somber conviction that what America has become by pursuing the war on terror is not what America was supposed to be. And the Q&A in Mystery is with John Verdon, author of Let the Devil Sleep, which puts a new spin on the serial killer plot.
In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, you've got two emerging series to make note of.
Yes, we do. One of the two book twos that we're featuring this week is Caliban's War by James S.A. Corey. That's actually a shared pseudonym for Daniel Abraham, who's a fantasy author, and Ty Frank, who is an assistant to this fellow named George Martin, who you might know. This is their science fiction series, big, expansive space opera called The Expanse. And the second book has aliens trying to spark war between Earth and Mars. And this is definitely a series to watch. The first book, Leviathan Wakes, is starting to get award nominations. It came out last year. Another notable book, too, is Queen's Hunt by Beth Bernabich. This is the follow-up to last year's novel Passion Play, which is her debut, and it's a fantasy novel with intrigue among nations, daring escapes, and magical jewels. And our reviewer says that all the promise of the first book is realized in the second. In romance, Chaban Bantwal's The Reluctant Matchmaker is a sweet story of unexpected love between a CEO and the woman he asks to help him write a personals ad. He's looking for someone tall and literally overlooking the short but perfect match who's right in front of him. Bantwal is well known for her entertaining portrayals of love and family life in New Jersey's Indian immigrant communities, and the reviewer says this is one of her best books yet.
In the comic section, it's the week after the Avengers opening, and you've got a report on the DC series that tries to bring its own super team together.
Yeah, we have Justice League Volume 1, Origin. This is by Jeff Johns, Jim Lee, and Scott Williams. And these are the first six issues of Justice League, which are a fast-paced and, our reviewer says, somewhat dramatically inert origin story for the Justice League. And this is all part of DC rebooting and their series called The New 52. Our reviewer says, the artwork reflects the industry standard for superhero tales. The dynamic action is masterfully staged while bodies suffer from anatomical hysteria. It's entertaining, but has the staying power of a stick of juicy fruit gum.
Ah, well, you know, if we were illustrating that review, it would be oof, I think.
Bam!
Bam! Pow. Exactly.
We're a little more positive about Infinite Horizon by Jerry Duggan and Phil Noto. This is an Eisner-nominated miniseries which sets Homer's Odyssey in a post-apocalyptic near future with fantastic results. Our reviewer says that the art and text create an uneasy tone. The story is not a comfortable one, and the world often feels askew, but it ends with both triumph and hope, making for a satisfying and thought-provoking story. We have a religion section this week. In The Good Life, The Moral Individual in an Anti-Moral World, Cheryl Mendelson, who's a philosophy professor at Barnard College, champions what she calls a moral mentality, and she tries to free the term from its contemporary servitude to the political right wing, even as she assesses the damage of being uncaringly cool. And it's a sharply written and invigorating book. Also, Implosion by Joel Rosenberg continues to sound the political alarm he raised in previous best-selling titles. He argues here that America is on the brink of economic, social, and spiritual catastrophe, and compares it to previous critical times in American history when spiritual awakening turned the country around. And he tells a very personal story, not just of his conversion to Christianity, but also of his conversion from a liberal Democrat to a conservative Republican.
In the nonfiction section, there are stories of spies and subversives.
Yeah, we have Double Cross by Ben McIntyre. This adds to his reputation as a master teller of true espionage tales. He's also the author of Agent Zigzag and Operation Mincemeat. And in Double Cross, he tells a dramatic story about laying the ground for D-Day, how England's MI5 handled five double agents who fed the Nazis false information on where the invasion would take place. And he effortlessly weaves the agents' deliciously eccentric personalities with larger wartime events to shape a fascinating read, and we'll have a Q&A with him in an upcoming issue. Also, while working as an investigative reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle, Seth Rosenfeld sued the FBI four times in 30 years to obtain confidential records under the Freedom of Information Act regarding the agency's covert campus activities at UC Berkeley. And so he's got a new book about that called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. And our reviewer says the book is narrative nonfiction at its best. Also, in Desert Reckoning, a town sheriff, a Mojave hermit, and the biggest manhunt in modern California history, journalist Dean Stillman, author of 29 Palms, uses a 2003 face-off between a brilliant, paranoid, drug-abusing hermit and a former surfer-turned-law enforcement officer, and the subsequent seven-day manhunt to frame a much larger story of the Mojave's Antelope Valley. This is based on her article in Rolling Stone, and we call it a beautifully written, humane book that preserves the history of a remarkable and very American place and its people. In Children's, we've got a review of a picture book from Second Lady Jill Biden about military families. We also have reviews of picture books from Tad Hills, Amy Krauss-Rosenthal, and Tom Lichtenheld. And for older readers, we have reviews of Tiger Lily, a reimagining of Peter Pan by Jody Lynn Anderson. There's also a new YA novel about a pregnant teenager whose mother sends her away to Spain. That's by Beth Kephart. And National Book Award winner Philip Hoose's latest work of nonfiction about a shorebird that makes an 18,000-mile migratory loop from the top of the world to the bottom every year. And this week we have a kids' comics section. Finally, in our online annex, we have Jenny Radosevich's I Spy DIY Style. This is a snazzy craft book with lots of projects for thrifty fashionistas, and it draws from her monthly InStyle magazine do-it-yourself column, explaining how to make everything from pink feather earrings to a Chanel-style jacket. On the fiction side, Rudy Rucker is often hailed as the mad professor of cyberpunk, and he has long been exploring the frontiers of adventurous fiction. So we cover Surfing the Gnarl Plus. This is a collection of entertaining fiction and nonfiction that showcases some of his wilder moments, with pieces reflecting on reality TV, space travel, sex, and robot salesmen. It's complex, intelligent, quirky, and yes, it's gnarly.
Well, Rose, from gnarly to kind of cute and fuzzy for the pick of the week.
Our pick of the week this week is The Further Tale of Peter Rabbit. You may have heard of Emma Thompson, the actress. She's also an author. This is her sequel to Beatrix Potter's The Tale of Peter Rabbit. The original book was published in 1902, so this new companion story is timed to mark the 110th anniversary, and it comes out in September.
Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville, thanks for the review of the reviews.
You're very welcome. Always a pleasure.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.